generation. God gives strength in loving arms, scatters the proud of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
The tradition of the oppressed teaches us that the state of emergency in which we live is not the exception, but the rule. Walter Benjamin, a Jewish philosopher who became one of the victims of fascism. We're continuing our series, Faith and Reason 360's response to COVID-19 and the devastating impact this pandemic is having on the lives of people throughout the world. Today, April 22nd, 2020, in the United States alone, there are 820,600 confirmed cases of COVID-19. 45,967 deaths. Worldwide, that figure is almost 3 million, with 180,578 deaths. I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm David Dykes.
And we're honored to have as our special guest, Dr. Jörg Rieger, Distinguished Professor of Theology and the Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies at Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Rieger is also the founding director of the Wendland Cook Program in Religion and Justice at Divinity School at Vanderbilt, which is the first of its kind, and that the program examines economic and ecological justice through the lens of theological and religious reflection. Welcome, Jörg.
Yeah, thank you so much, Debo and David. It's great to be with you, and I look forward to this conversation today, even though it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah, is it okay, Jörg, if I call you Jörg instead of Dr. Rieger?
Of course, please. Yes,
well, we are friends.
Always. Yeah, we're good friends. Yes, thank you, Debo.
Well, I want to start with this, Jörg. There is much uncertainty about the coronavirus and the effect it will have on the future. But early health and economic indicators are pretty bleak. And across the board, low-income workers are taking the biggest hits. Would you explain why the oppressed are hit the hardest, and why would a theologian such as yourself would care, and why should people of faith care?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really a big question too, Debo. So let me start by saying that maybe the problem, a lot of people are outraged at the moment, and there's failures, shortcomings. There's individuals, leaders, presidents, and so on, who are all committing some mistakes and are sort of troubled in this. But the bigger thing, I think, really has to do with how the system is functioning. So beyond what anybody as an individual contributes, the bigger question is, how have we structured this world in such a way that some people benefit and others don't? And I think what we see in this moment is that working people are not benefiting. And of course, that's something that we might have known if we had paid attention sooner. But right now, it's just as clear as it could be. And we're now even talking about these workers as essential workers, which is another thing I want to come back to a little bit later, because that changes the way we look at things. So my first comment is the reason why some people are taking the brunt of the hit really has to do with the system in which we find ourselves. And as theologians, I think this is our problem. We're always dealing with systems. And so this bigger system that we see unfold before us is also a theological system. It has to do with where do we see God in all of this? You know, how is the world functioning? Is this God's will? What is, you know, the response that people of faith would have to give here? And that too is a system. And so in a way, the economic system, the political system, and the religious system work together to make the situation as it is actually worse in many cases. Not always, but in this case, I think we see that problem.
Well, Jörg, I'm aware of just a very few comments that are being made from the pulpit, so to speak, just people speaking out. And, you know, where is God in the midst of this COVID-19 crisis? It seems like there are some taking advantage and putting out some horrific information, and then there are others that are making an attempt to tell the truth about what's really going on. So I'm just curious if you could speak to some of these people that are putting out insightful information in terms of God's role in the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you have any comments about that?
Right, yes. I think, you know, if you start from the most blatant examples, there are some people out there, and I think most of your listeners would be aware of it, that are talking about this COVID pandemic as a punishment by God.
Yes.
This is what God sends to the world, you know, in revenge for something wrong. And, you know, whatever these folks who make these arguments don't like, that's what is seen to differ to merit the punishment. And I think that's, of course, a huge problem. And it's not too hard to see that this is just sort of people claiming to speak for God who really have no clue about it. That's sort of the big problem. But again, if you look at that system that I'm talking about, I think we've developed a system where, you know, the people in power are seen to be in control. They're usually seen as the heroes that can save us, that need special consideration. And in theology, the same thing happens to God. We have developed a system where we think about God as at the top, controlling everything, mm-hmm. running the show, you know, creating things this way or that way. And I think that's what's breaking down here, because it's really makes no sense to say that God is making this happen. I mean, what interest would God have in punishing all of humanity, every human being, right? Why should mm-hmm. this happen? So those are just some examples of really bad theology out there. You know, you have some bad theological stuff that's preached from the pulpit. You have some bad theological systems. So my question is always, what's the alternative? Well, how could it be different? And here I would like to talk about God, not as above looking down from the sky, but God in the midst of it all. You know, how is God responding here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a Christian perspective, we think about Jesus Christ as an incarnation of God. And with this incarnation, you know, we can say, well, God's right here. And then we can be more specific and say, well, how's God responding? Now, I have some ideas about that, but I think that's a conversation that we need to be having and that we have to develop. And then we can move back into the bigger picture.
Jörg, you speak in some of your material about the logic of downturn. Can you say something about that within the context of what you've just said about this system, which is very broken?
Yes, this is a term I actually coined in 2009. A book of mine was published that year, which was titled No Rising Tide, Theology, Economics, and the Future, published by Fortress Press. And as you can imagine, in 2009, that book was written during what we called the Great Recession. And what occurred to me in that time is, you know, sometimes you really see reality, the whole world, better when you look at it from the underside, when you look at it from a perspective that's not commonly assumed by those at the top. And when we were doing that in this aftermath of the Great Recession, we began to see how many people were really affected. And again, the same thing as is happening now, the people most affected were the people, sort of working people, common people, many of them who lost everything, and of course that includes also minorities, racial minorities, ethnic minorities, immigrants, and so on. So that logic of downturn, the way I was arguing back then, is something that simply broadens our view to reality in a way that we're not really used to thinking about it. And that's useful for theologians also. What, say, talking about God as we did a minute ago, what if we thought about God from this perspective of downturn rather than thinking about God from the top down? What happens if we think about God from the bottom up, from the perspective mm-hmm. of a working person, mm-hmm. or what we now call from the perspective of an essential worker? And then you get two things. This is what we should develop further in this interview. On the one hand, the downturn shows you how messed up this system really is, right. Where are the faults and the crevices, and where's the sort of stuff that does not work anymore. And on the other hand, this logic of downturn points you to hope in a different way. People still hope that somebody will come in from the top, from the outside, and save them. Mm-hmm. But the logic of downturn says, if this is the way things are messed up, there must be something we can do to fix it. And the surprise then is, if you look from the underside, you see a whole different group of actors and people and community and religious ideas. This is part of that story, the Jesus story as I see it, that really works to change the world from the bottom up. So downturn does both. It shows us the reality in a clearer light, but it also helps us to find some hope in places where we had not expected it.
I would think that at this point, with 22 million people unemployed in the United States alone, what would a theologian or someone in the ministry say to these people who might be feeling at this point that they have been forsaken by God and they're desperate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And here I think we really have to turn around the interpretation. Rather than saying that COVID is sent as a punishment by God, we could say, COVID shows how we have structured our world in a way that's not at all the way God wants it. So rather than COVID being a punishment, COVID is really just helping us see how the system is working or not working anymore for the majority of people. So the theological thing here is not to put blame on anybody, but to ask the question, and how are we going to get out of this? Mm-hmm. Now, one way to do it, of course, is really to pay attention to who is affected the most. And in a lot of the conversations that I see, we're talking about how this affects big corporations, how it affects the government, how it affects the stock market. But maybe we really have to start talking about, like you did just now, Debo, those many, many millions of unemployed mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Jörg, I want to ask you about, I've heard you say that we had an opportunity back in the Great Recession, 2009, I was so heartened by all the demonstrations, the Occupy movement, Black Lives Matter, and so forth. But we seem to have had some energy about those things, and then it didn't take too long until the system did the same thing the system always does. What impressed you about how both the media and even government gave an interpretation to the Great Recession? How did they spin it so that we lost kind of that first energy that we felt when we saw these people making these demonstrations?
Thanks, David. That's a really important question. And I think it takes us back to this quote from Walter Benjamin that Debo read in the beginning, where the tradition of the oppressed teaches us that the state of emergency is not the exception but the rule. And I think that's exactly what happened in the Great Recession. You know, the assumption was, I mean, people were really worried. I mean, those of us who lived through it probably remember some of it existentially, you know, how it affected us and what all it did to us. But it really depends if you think this is just an exception or if you think this is the way the system actually functions. So as an exception, this is, of course, how then those in power and people sort of had the upper hand wanted to spin it to say, oh, these things happen, it's not that big a deal. Everything will go back to normal. And as you know, what happened, the stock market eventually did get back to normal and kept rising and rising and rising until February 2020. That's, of course, one perspective. If you look at the title of my book back in 2009, No Rising Tide, I knew back then that the tide is always ebbing and flowing, right? The stock market would go back up. That was not the question. But what the question was at the time was, and what's happening to the rest of us? And what we realized was that the tide was rising for some, but for more and more people, that the tide was not rising anymore. And this is what happened since 2009, that a lot of people have already been left out. You know, a lot of wages and salaries were stagnating. The jobs that came back after the Great Recession were not of the same quality. People didn't have the same benefits, didn't have the same relationship, you know, at work that they had before. All of that was downgraded. And so what really happened was, it was not an exception, as we were made to believe. That was the new normal. That was the new rule. And I'm worried that this is what's going to happen again, you know, that people will continue, maybe be forced to lower their expectations. And as that happens, you know, then, you know, maybe this is seen as another exception. But we should see it as the rule as to what's happening to working people in many cases. But let me add one other thing that's really interesting here. If you take this back a little further in history, not the Great Recession, but the Great Depression. What happened in the Great Depression, of course, we had similar market crashes that went on for years. This is what we're facing now. It's not just happening now, but what's happening now could go on for years potentially. But as a result of the Great Depression, there was another response. Namely, there was, you know, a way of reorganizing certain things. There was a way of, you know, beginning reflections on the value of working people. This is when the unions gained some strength. This is when, you know, the New Deal sort of was created out of that. And so the Great Depression is a different example than what happened after the Great Recession. And my hope is we can learn something from that earlier experience where we're not going back to the way things were.
Well, and what was so clear in there being a real difference is that as we tried to deal with the Great Depression, of course I wasn't even born yet, but there was this new moral authority about how regular people live, and so the primary action of the government, at least if I'm correct about this, was to put people to work, was to imagine projects that would employ people. And it's what gave a new recognition of what working people contribute. Now, that's all been lost. And the truth is that today, these solutions being put forth from the get-go have been to benefit corporations. And, you know, it's like, why can't we get an aggregate awareness of the fact that the corporations are not going to do anything about this problem? And while COVID-19 shows us not what's just happened, but what always happens. Right. I mean, COVID-19 has just taken the skin off the whole thing, and we can see now what it's like for people who are always vulnerable, even when they're working. You know, they can have a little car wreck or someone gets sick, and they're down on their knees again.
Right, and that's why in 2009 I said, you know, we really have to look at this from the underside. This is that logic of downturn thing that people are experiencing all the time, even when the stock market is doing okay. As we know in our own country, more and more people were not doing okay. And that includes large masses. So this is not just a few. I mean, sometimes in the U.S. we think there are a few poor people, a few homeless people, and everybody else is fine. But what we realized rather was that all the way into the middle class, more and more people are not doing fine. We know that more and more people are only a few paychecks away from bankruptcy. Yes. We know, you know, that the jobs that we're holding now are not what they used to be in terms of, not just in terms of pay, but in terms of benefits and in terms of the relationship to the companies. So the problem, go back to the systemic issue that we were talking about a moment ago. We now have a system that assumes we can only solve problems from the top down, and therefore this is where we have to put the money. You know, if there's a bailout, it starts at the top. There's other bailouts also, as you know. You know, there's just the other day, or I think yesterday, there was some announcement about a fund for small businesses.
Right.
But that pales in comparison to what money is spent at the very top. And that's not just, you know, something that we can turn off at will. That's part of the system and of the way we're approaching and seeing the world. And that has to change also.
Yes.
And we're still frightened. Even today, I saw some headlines that even with this new passing of these billions of dollars that are directed towards small businesses, which I thought the previous stimulus package was also directed towards small business, and now we know it was consumed primarily by larger corporations, leaving the small businesses
by the same interest and the same people that always suck everything dry.
Right, and now the fear again is that money will not be able to reach these small businesses because of some hidden or minor ruling that will prevent these individuals from getting this help, not unlike the little clause or the ruling that you had to be affiliated with a bank. And so certain banks received the stimulus money and then distributed that money to these businesses. And so many thousands and thousands and thousands of small businesses never received a penny.
And probably won't last. I mean, probably will, unless something changes. There are many that are not going to make it through this.
Right.
Let me take this back to the question you asked earlier. You know, why should a theologian worry about this? You know, why is this important for people of faith? And I think what you were just saying, both of you, you know, about the system, describing it a bit more, how all the attention goes to the top, that is the type of religion that we have developed, certainly in Christianity.
Yes.
You know, this is something, my most recent book is titled Jesus versus Caesar.
Yes.
For people the subtitle was sort of tongue-in-cheek, for people tired of serving the wrong God.
Yes.
And here I'm saying very clearly and loudly to everybody who wants to hear it, in a lot of our religious communities, we have come to serve the wrong God. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by the wrong God, of course, you know, in this Christian story, it was the God of the Roman empires. Of course, there were maybe several, but the emperor was also seen as God. So that's your Caesar as God. And the problem there is it always goes from the top down. The hope is always seen somebody up there can save us, and then of course there is no money, no funding left for the bottom. There is really no concern left for the bottom. And that's a huge theological problem. The good news is, and that's the whole point of my theological work, there is an alternative. It does not yes. have to be like that.
Right.
Religion does not have to shape up like that. And that's, in this moment, I think, the great glimmer of hope. What if there was something else going on? And then let's talk about what that could be.
Even the imagery that is used primarily in the Christian tradition is a pyramid. So you look up into the quote-unquote heavens. So you've got automatically a visual hierarchical
yeah,
system.
Exactly.
And if we could just not look up as if God is somewhere out here up looking down over us, if we could just move beyond that image and look at an image with where God is at work here, present, eye level, within each and every one of us, and we are each and every one valued with a voice so that we can make a difference in the systems that are keeping people oppressed. And the church is a big part of that system.
I want to know, why is the church today, and there are some exceptions, but why is there such silence?
Yeah.
And of course, we know why. I mean, a lot of churches, ministers, pastors, they're afraid that if they speak to the truth, or if they speak, as they say, truth to power, that they're going to lose support and the whole thing's going to crater. And in some cases, that's truth. That's going to happen. But we seem more timid today. If you think back of the years during the civil rights movement, even the resistance to the war in Vietnam, we seem to have lost, again, with some very keen exceptions like yourself, we seem to have lost our courage. And I'm just wondering what can help us find that courage again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, ultimately, this is why I continue to do my work as a theologian. Because I think there are all these implications in religion that could be spelled out, and they're constantly being spelled out, really, in politics and economics. So if you look sort of on the one side that we just discussed, you now have the churches, a lot of people of faith, worshiping power and might. And this happens in economics, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the large corporations and those who run them who seem to have the biggest priority in this crisis. It also happens in politics. And I think you can see this in the fact that a lot of people of faith are somehow worshiping a strong leader, you know, whoever
yes.
that is
mm-hmm.
at the moment.
Yes.
We have somebody in the White House who presents himself as a strong leader. And no matter how strong they are or not, the assumption is there is somebody who can help us. That's, of course, what Walter Benjamin found mm-hmm. in his own world, right? In Germany, where there was one strong person that everybody hoped would save us, and that never worked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it
yes.
worked in the Roman Empire, even sort of as we all know, it is no more. It did not work long time. It was not sustainable. And so your question, David, what's on the other side? I think the amazing thing is there's always also resistance. I mean, we've had resistance in the past. You know, you mentioned the civil rights movement. Earlier, you mentioned the Occupy Wall Street movement, mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter. We now have the environmental justice movement. Oh, let's not forget, today is actually Earth Day. This is the
yes.
day of
yes.
the environmental justice movement, and I think it's
right.
the 50th anniversary. So
is.
That is another great example for how there has always been resistance. And if we talk about religion in regard to this, we could say there are not just individual theologians and great minds who have been on those sides, but they're also communities of faith. They're grassroots communities. You know, a lot of my students at Vanderbilt Divinity School would be among them. The students, our fellows in the Wendling Cook Program for Religion and Justice at Vanderbilt. And as you know, you're in Jackson, Mississippi. There's mm-hmm. things happening there, even in the south of the United States, where a lot of people would not even suspect it.
Mm-hmm. Jörg, you mentioned Earth's Day, and I want to deviate just a tiny bit, and then we'll come back. But it is Earth Day, and for me, I've done so much reading into the science of the origin of viruses, and in particular, COVID-19, which is a virus that grew out of the SARS virus. And as I read and study this material, and I wish it was available to everyone and everyone would take time to listen to the scientists and what's happening, that I can't help but be impressed by the fact that we have made choices throughout history, and that there is accountability for the choices that we've made. You could say, what is the nature of your God, as has been said, and if you believe in a punishing God, or do you believe in a God that heals, or do we just look at God's creation and earth and imagine not God actually hands-on manipulating things, but God looking at us and scratching God's head and wondering, what is going on here? Don't you see humans, that there is, you have a responsibility to Earth, and if you don't take on and this responsibility and treat it with respect, then there will be consequences. There are always consequences for the choices we make, and viruses are consequences of choices that human beings have made and continue to make. Will we ever pay attention to that?
Can I step in and just add something to that?
Please.
One of the things that keeps coming through, because what we're talking about is, where are signs of hope for change? Where are real actions being taken that give us hope about how the system could be? At the core of it for me has been my recognition that I have been willing, as you're just talking about, Debo, to make the same kinds of choices that I've always made. And Devo and I talk about what we eat and what it takes to provide what we eat, and how's the earth affected by the whole food industry, which it is, of course. And then, you know, I've always, first I got a Prius so that I could, you know, help with the environment and gas emissions. But the truth is, in order to see the changes we want to see, isn't it true that we have to be willing to make some pretty big and difficult choices ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know what you're talking about, and I think what we can see here is how everything is connected. So you have, yeah, on the one hand, you know, what's happening in the natural world, ecology, Earth Day, related to the economic system, related to the political system, related to religion. And as we sort of try to figure that out, there's some really interesting insights where what we're learning is we could be doing things differently. What we're doing right now, it does not have to be that way. I think that is probably the biggest insight that could come out of this crisis. You know, what we're doing right now, it does not have to be that way. I mean,
right.
Let me start even sort of with this. I mean, whatever happens with the virus, the response to the virus is also interesting, because we have a global pandemic and we can see that some countries are doing better than others. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing that well in the United States. I think that's pretty obvious.
Right.
I don't have to rub that in for anyone. But how come others are doing this better? You know, there you have to look at politics, there you have to look at economics. But we're still facing the big problems, and that's true also for the globe. Let me make a little plug here. At Vanderbilt Divinity, we have this big project that we are titling Liberating People and the Planet. And this is coming out of a conference that unfortunately had to be canceled in March because of COVID, that was to focus on the relation of religion, economics, and ecology. We'll start producing that content now through webinars, so if your listeners are interested, starting on May 13, we will have our first webinar on the topic religion, ecology, and economics. You can find the information on our website, which is religion and justice, one word, religionandjustice.org, and then go to the events page on the drop-down menu, and you will find it. And what we're saying in this whole context is we really have to go back and see how the various players have created part of those problems. So economics, you know, a lot of people say the problem is that we have too many human beings on the planet. We don't think that's the problem. The problem is how the human economy is run. We're thinking the fact that some people, you know, are doing so much better and have so much more wealth and power than others, that's part of the problem, not the sheer number of people. Religion, same thing, you know, there is lots of arguments that religion has contributed to a disregard for nature because it was just not interested in that. The good thing here is that there's resources in many religious traditions, including Christianity, that are much more appreciative of the environment, of ecology. So we have to reclaim those, and then see what are the political consequences. So there's a really big topic, but I think there's some really good work that's also being done, and I look forward sort of to being in conversation about that as well.
I do too.
I guess we'll have to save that for next time.
Yeah.
Before we leave this part of the conversation, York, I'm curious of what your perspective is on the $1,200 in your mailbox stimulus money that's supposedly coming to people.
That's an interesting one. I mean, it's better than nothing, I guess. You know, if people have some support that really need it, that's great. But realistically speaking, $1,200, a one-time stimulus of $1,200 is not a whole lot, especially for people who have lost jobs, who have, maybe even are in danger of losing housing or anything like that. So it's interesting to see that and compare with literally trillions of dollars that are spent at the top of the economy. But I think it shows us again what's really valued. You see this, I think, all around us. You see this in salaries too, right? Even in times when we're not in a so-called crisis, who is making the big bucks and who isn't. Now, the interesting thing, and I want to make this clear at the end of our podcast today, because hopefully we can talk about this in the next podcast. But what's happening now is this is the problem. I think it's pretty obvious to see, and I mean, nobody would say $1,200 saved me in the end, because that's not enough. That just doesn't work. But on the other hand, we're seeing a gradual shift in perspective. For instance, in the fact that workers that were always sort of considered, well, workers are worker, not that important. We now have this term essential workers. We know that there are people that we need without which we could not survive. And the list here, of course, in the front lines, right, includes grocery workers, food workers, certain services,
sanitation workers,
That's right. I mean, nurses, doctors, hospitals. I mean, this is now clear who are the essential workers. And, you know, that's the logic of downturn. You see who is essential. Right. Whereas before, we saw, you know, the world was built from the top down. You know, Caesar built the Roman Empire. You know, Henry Ford built the Ford Motor Company. But without a working person, not a single wheel would have turned Ford Motor Company ever. Mm-hmm. Not even in the early days, and certainly not today. And so this is where the hope lies. Not only are we beginning to see who is really pulling the weight, I think this is an opportunity to see we can also make changes that treat people better, differently. And it's not just helping people and treating them better, it's also thinking about agency. Who has the power? Up to now, we thought, you know, the power is all somewhere at the top. Now we're realizing there's a lot more power at the bottom. And the beauty of it is the workers themselves are beginning to realize that.
Great.
They do have that power. We've seen some strikes. We've seen some action. We've seen a little bit of a shift already. It's just the question, can we maintain that? Can we continue that? And let me add the theological piece here too. Mm-hmm. If you think about God now, not as a CEO or as an emperor or as something like that, but you think about God as a working person. And there's plenty of material in the Bible on that. You know, second creation story, God forms Adam from clay. There's a garden that God plants, not some migrant workers. You know, God in the Hebrew Bible is oftentimes described as somebody who works with the hands, you know, gets the fingers dirty, and oftentimes doing the work that women do, including, you know, pottery, cooking, planting, gardening. That classically used to be work that was often done by women. You see God at work there. You see working people gaining some power, gaining some visibility. That's part of what I think we need to talk about as where the hope is coming from.
Yeah, the seamstress, I don't want to leave them out, who are making masks for nurses and doctors.
Well, what you're describing is all the people that the culture taught us forever were not important are now showing up. We're seeing it on television every day, blanketing all the news media. We're seeing how working people are doing the heavy lifting, and not those groups at the top who think they have the answer for everything. A final point, and I'm going to step back.
All right.
I want to address next time, I want to address this insanity that exists in a lot of Western thinking, that the only way to fix anything is to make profits. And that is such an unaware notion about how life can actually function. There's some things we ought to do where the common good is the goal and not who makes money off of it. Just wanted to put that in there.
You can twist that around, David, and say, you know, profits, the real question is who makes them. So in Nashville now, we have a new entity called the Southeast Center for Cooperative Development, which is, of course, in high demand at this point as people are losing their jobs.
Yes.
And once people work together cooperatively, cooperative businesses and so on, all of a sudden you can say, well, maybe profit is good if it flows back into the community instead of into sort of special interests at the very top. Also, let me add to that, again, we're not looking at individuals as bad guys or CEOs as bad people, but we're looking at a system that basically suggests this is the way the world has to go. And what we're saying, you're saying it, Debo is saying it, I'm saying it, there is another way.
Yes.
And that's why we're talking about it, not just to critique and to be down. That the logic of downturn is not a downer. It's simply a logic that helps us to see what are the alternatives and how can we build something else that's hopeful and that's really promising.
Right. Jörg, I think you've moved our listeners to the edge of their seats, and they're going to have to be patient. because I want to remind everyone that this is a two-part series, and episode. There'll be a part one and part two of this particular episode. And so, Jörg, I want to thank you for being with us today. And
it's always good.
Yes. And David, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, David and Debo, for having me. I greatly enjoyed the conversation and look forward to the next time.
Yes, I look forward to us talking again, part two, which we will do, which we will offer within a couple of weeks after this particular one. Please join us for another episode of Faith and Reason 360's response to COVID-19. We will resume our discussion with Dr. Rieger for part two of COVID-19 and God. This has been a production of the D.L. Deitch Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason educational programming. Please visit our website at www.faithandreason.org.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children evermore.